Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and our program hosts. Now let's join our host, Chris Kington Barker, and our guests. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Donna. Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation, is quoted as saying, "The film The Chaplain and the Doctor is a timely and compelling documentary exploring hidden dangers of implicit bias in a healthcare system. By focusing on the close relationship between a black chaplain and a white Jewish doctor, the film highlights the power of human-to-human connection in healing in an increasingly divided society." My guests today are that chaplain and the doctor, Chaplain Betty Clark, chaplain on staff at the Wilma Chan Highland Hospital campus, a level one trauma center in Oakland, California. Additionally, she's a teacher, a matriarch, great-grandmother, and a church founder who will be learning much more about in the next hour, along with Dr. Jessica Zitter, a documentary filmmaker, a writer, a physician, a founder of REEL, and that's spelled R-E-E-L, which I think is very clever, Medicine Media, and nonprofit devoted to using story to transform and humanize medical culture. Jessica was featured in the subject as the subject and member of a team that created the Oscar and Emmy nominated film Extremis in 2016. She went on to direct and produce Caregiver, A Love Story in 2020 and authored Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life Care in to the end of life care in 2017. I invite you to be a part of today's discussion, or you can be a good listener and listen to today's discussion. But if you have questions or comments, we welcome them. And you can call us at 805-781-3875. We'd love to have you be part of this discussion. And Betty and Jessica, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
You know, I think probably the place to start is a little bit about the background of how the two of you even began this journey, because this has been a journey for the two of you. You've been working together for a while, and you come from healthcare, but from two very different places in healthcare. One is a chaplain and someone who attends to the soul and the spirit, and the other that attends to the medical. How did that formation, that transformation start to begin?
Go ahead. Well, this is Betty, and I love Jessica's energy, and she loves my calmness. That is a great combination.
It is indeed.
You know, I would say for me, you know, as you see in the film, I was not really expecting to pair up or even become close friends with a chaplain. I didn't really know about chaplaincy, and I was part of this sort of hierarchical thinking in the hospital that I think is really damaging, but I just didn't think we had much cross-pollination to have.
When you talk about hierarchical thinking in hospitals, you're talking about the physician rules.
Yeah, I think Betty, I'm actually curious to hear how Betty puts that, but I think that there is definitely a hierarchy. Betty, what would you say about that?
Well, I started as a chaplain in hospice, and I felt like I was always fighting for my voice to be heard. Mm. And when I came to palliative care, I was told that I was a colleague. So that is what I ran with.
Yeah, so you ran with what you were told, not how you were being treated?
Right.
Good for you. Absolutely. Good for you. Betty, did you feel like as a chaplain, Were you also seeing yourself as a patient advocate?
After a while,
yeah.
You know, after I began to work with patients, I found that I had to be an mm-hmm. advocate because doctors don't have time, a lot of them, to hear the stories and know what the patient really is feeling.
Yeah.
But I would say that doctors have more time than they think that they do.
Yeah, and Jessica, I'm curious too, as where you started from, not where you are now, obviously at all, but did you, as a physician in the standardized physician position in a very busy hospital, did you see yourself as a physician, as a patient advocate?
I think that I didn't, I probably would have used those words that I'm advocating for patients, but not in the way that I understand it now.
Yeah. What's the difference, do you think?
I think advocating for a patient doesn't mean just taking care of a medical problem. It has to be thinking of them as a whole person and attending to them as a person. And that is just a lot more than just fixing a disease or looking at an organ.
Yeah. You and Betty, I mean, Jessica, you and I met around the time that you were releasing the film Caregiver Love Story. And
yes,
that was a pivotal film for you in terms of how you were seeing healthcare for patients at end of life care. Can you talk a little bit about that transition for you?
Yeah, that was, you know, making that film, very much the way making The Chaplain and the Doctor was really humbling for me, because through the process of making these films, I have learned things about healthcare and about myself that I wasn't expecting to learn. And Caregiver, A Love Story, I really did not know much about the problem of family caregiver burden, and I wasn't setting out to make a film about caregiver burden. I just saw it happening in the rough cut. As we were getting rough cuts together, I saw this caregiver, and I could not ignore his trajectory and what was happening to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was a Jewish family that you were watching really go through end-of-life care and the burden that it put on the gentleman who was trying to attend to his wife and attend to a grandchild simultaneously.
Right. It was pretty painful to watch.
Yeah, and before that, I think you mentioned to me how you would discharge patients to hospice care and think that they were being fully cared for.
Right. That's right. Oh, we got this taken care of. Everything's okay now. And in fact, as I learned, and Betty can actually attest to, because she worked in hospice for a long time, that just isn't that is a little bit of a fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's more of a fantasy now than it was when I began working in hospice, because at that time there were a lot of volunteers and a lot of resources. And today, that's just not the case.
Yeah, there are fewer resources.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how it was that two women like yourself who worked together began to find that there was better work together in combining? Was there a pivotal moment? Was there a patient that kind of centered the two to you that, wait a minute, this worked in a way that we haven't worked before?
Well, actually, I could quickly say that, and I wrote an article about this a long time ago in the New York Times, which really was about my impact working with Betty and being in the room with Betty, that a lot of my patients, you could just feel the sense of distrust and distance between us. And when I would go into the room with Betty, it was such a different experience. It was almost as if she was building a bridge that I could cross over to the patient that I couldn't do on my own.
Mm. What do you think was the difference?
Trust, connection, and primarily Betty's desire to hear people's story, which I would hear as I was standing behind her.
Well, you know, as a chaplain, when I go into a patient's room, I don't have to do anything. I have to hear and look and listen, and people feel that. They feel when you are present but not saying anything. Because a lot of times our words just drown out what the patient is feeling. And so when you just come in at a point when you have heard them, makes a difference. And once a patient feels heard, they respond differently to all the other caregivers.
Yeah. How do you think a patient would respond, Betty, if the physician just came into the room and stood silent?
I look at them intently. I reach for their hand if they want to hold the hand.
Yeah.
And just sit. And the conversation begins, or it doesn't, but comfort happens.
But Chris is asking, what do you think a patient would feel if you if a doctor walked into the room and didn't say anything?
Oh, that's a whole different thing. Because they expect the doctor to say something. I had a patient who said, the doctor came in and just stood back against the wall. And he said, act like he was in kindergarten and didn't know what to say. And so they are really expecting the doctors to say something, but not to just come in and say, have you drank your insure today? You know, they want them to be personal.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really sounds like it takes different members of the team to complete the work.
It does.
Yeah.
It really does. I would like to see an interdisciplinary team on every team, like the medical team, the surgery team, to have a social worker and a chaplain, when they're going to visit a patient, go in with them. It would make a big difference.
Talk a little bit about the kind of healthcare setting the hospital that you work together in is. It's a level trauma one center, correct?
It is.
And so, go ahead.
It is also a hospital that is very diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our patients are underserved and under-resourced. And when patients are underserved and under-resourced, they look different than maybe in another kind of hospital. And they need to be treated in a different way.
Can you give an example of that, Betty?
Yes. When a patient comes in and they have been living on the street,
yeah,
they're dirty, they're hungry, but maybe the hospital gives them food, but when you're struggling for food, you never have enough because you don't know where the next meal is going to come from. And they need to be cleaned. They need to be treated in a dignified way so that they feel like their humanity has come back because it's been taken away.
And how do you do that?
I advocate.
You advocate.
Tell the story about the CEO.
Yeah. Yes,
our CEO came to my office one day because I also do some collage art. He wanted to see it. And so as he was leaving, I said, can I tell you about a patient we have? And he said, yes. So I said, we have a patient. He has not had a shower in 2 weeks because I know that because I asked the nurse. And the nurse said, no, he had not had a shower. His bed was dirty. His hands and fingernails were dirty. And he had empty trays on the floor. He'd eaten all the food, but he wanted more. And I said, I told the CEO, I said, you know, we feed him, but as a homeless person, he doesn't feel like he's getting enough. So that night, the CEO made sure that that patient was showered and cleaned and fed and had food always sitting by his bed. And it made a difference in how he was able to relate to us as a team, and we were able to help him because now he could communicate.
Mm-hmm. Because he was seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
His humanity was restored.
How do you teach that to staff?
By walking with them. You know, and I don't have to walk with everybody in the hospital. It spreads. Our hospital is changing.
Yeah.
The staff is more open. They're more, they want hugs. I give hugs. I tell people, I don't charge for a hug. Hug is free if you want one. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's really important to, you know, it's important to understand the human tendency to stay away from people when you don't understand them, you don't know their story, you feel negative energy coming from them, et cetera. And I can speak personally to the fact that when I am with Betty, there's something magical that happens where somehow she helps me or she opens patients up in a way that you can connect a human to human being. And I think that's what's missing so frequently. And it's not just about patients who are hungry or dirty. It's also about patients who you may not like because they remind you of your father or because mm-hmm. they have a certain type of tattoo. I mean, there's so many reasons that there can be barriers between patients and their healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. And I think that the truth that I have learned is that maybe 99% of the time, if you just open up the picture and spend a little time and give a little space to understanding the person's story, what they're going through, there's room for the humanity to creep back in.
Yeah.
There are three things that I go with. First is difference is not wrong. It's just different.
Yeah.
And I'm not afraid to ask, even if I'm uncomfortable. And it's not about me. When someone is angry and they're holding that anger and they're cursing everybody out, it's not about the person that came in. You just walked in the room. It's about what they came in carrying. So it's not about me.
And by not personalizing it, you're not judging it either, correct?
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What, Betty, you come from the South, right?
Right.
And you've been through the racism of healthcare as well in the South and probably mm-hmm. here as well. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that? Because there's some, you know, I think it's easy for us to say if we haven't experienced racism in healthcare that it doesn't exist. But we're not just talking about racism in healthcare because of color. It can be like you're talking about someone who's unhoused. Or someone who has a really deep accent and is difficult to understand. Can you talk a little bit about in healthcare how that does exist and the impact it has?
Well, I can talk about it from my experience sure. as an African-American woman in the South. I lived in the rural South, and we had one hospital for three counties. And in that one hospital, they only allowed African Americans to be in two rooms.
Out of the whole hospital.
So those two rooms and the whole hospital. And we had two doctors in our town. Only one would see African Americans. And even when I came out here, I have poison from arsenic, poison from the fat tobacco, which caused skin cancer. So I went to a doctor, a dermatologist, and I had undressed in my gown sitting on the table. And he walks in, he stands at the door, he doesn't even come into the room. And he says, well, what's this about skin cancer? He said, I don't believe that. I need to see pathology reports. And I said, so why don't you believe it? He said, well, you know, African Americans don't really get skin cancer. And so I said, you can leave. And he said, what? I said, you can leave because I'm going to put my clothes on and you won't touch me. So it's the judgments that people have about different people, not just African Americans, but because people are different.
Yeah.
And what we see at Highland is that our doctors are now more diverse.
Yes.
And that makes a big difference.
And how has it made a difference that you see in a positive or a negative way?
Well, I only see it positive. I haven't seen negative.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
You know, when a patient, African-American patient is in bed and there's an African-American doctor that comes in and, you know, the same doctor, not all the time, but just being able to identify that there is an African-American doctor in this hospital who can see me makes a difference.
Yeah.
Or Asian. We have a lot of Asian doctors. We have a lot of Hispanic doctors. We have that we're a diverse hospital, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
I call Highland my beloved hospital.
And how, Jessica, how are you seeing the hospital in Oakland? And do you practice exclusively there or in other institutions as well?
I just practice it in Highland Hospital. I've been there since 2009, and it is also my beloved hospital. I just have such, it feels like a home. I mean, it really, people really kind of come together. It feels like it's a community hospital. The people who come to Highland live in Oakland. Many of them were born in Highland Hospital, and there's just something very special about it. And I think also the healthcare providers, including people like me who don't come from the community, really, there is just this sort of force of connection that we can be a part of as well. And as I said, Betty being my dear colleague and friend has made it easier for me to integrate, but it's a place that's very welcoming and very loving and accepting. Although I want to say, there is serious distrust, which you can't help but understand. Many patients really, and you see it in the film a couple of times, many do not trust their white doctors. There is such a history of experimentation and neglect, as you just heard Betty tell you her own story of terrible neglect. You can hear more details about it, but this is a reality of our country, and I think people are sort of in position to distrust the system.
Yeah, and the other thing we have to say about Highland is that it's in a setting of a complex of hospitals. So we're AHS, Alameda Health Care System. And so we have San Leandro Hospital, Alameda Hospital, we have John George, we have Fairmont Long-Term Care Facility, we have nursing homes, and we have clinics. So it's a good-sized system. Highland happens to be the largest hospital in the system.
And do you find that the kind of attitude or the kind of culture that you're trying to bring into Highland is also the kind of culture that is being integrated into the rest of the system?
It's growing.
That's really what you can hope for. Yeah, that's really what you can hope for.
You could go. I've worked in many, many hospitals in my long career. Some of the, you know, most tertiary care, kind of high level, you know, fancy schmancy. This is a problem that is a part of healthcare in general. This is not a Highland problem. In fact, if I could say, I think Highland is doing better than most at repairing this problem. This is a problem of the human brain. The human brain likes to label and categorize, and that is part of our society at large, and it's part of healthcare, even in the fanciest hospitals.
Well, and Jessica, you trained at Harvard, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will say it's no different, and maybe even a little bit worse, because what happens when people get comfortable with status and with I'm the healer and you're the patient and that kind of feeling of I'm above you, is when we open up the door for labeling, stereotyping, racism, and other types of prejudice.
What do you talked about how, you know, you're in your filmmaking, when you look at the footage, when you go back and look at it, that it's humbling. For instance, Caregiver, Love Story was humbling for you to see that there was so much more to caregiving than you discharge and you've done your work and they go away and everything's fine. What's a humbling story for you as a physician, Jessica, that kind of comes to mind about this?
Well, people can watch the story and see just some good examples right there. There's so many of them that exist, but even in the film, we were able to capture a few moments where I am clearly not behaving in the way that I would like to be, that I would be proud of.
Yeah.
And that's why this is just a constant learning for me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I loved in Caregiver that you were one of the first people to point out, you know, that's not my best self there. That's not how I would have wanted to respond there. I responded like a physician who was acting like a physician rather than human to human there. I didn't even see that. Yeah.
But but I'd like to say that since working with Jessica, I've experienced her compassion and care about what's happening to the patients, and we've become sometimes investigators. We're running around trying to find out who did this and who insulted this patient. Let's find them, Betty. You know. So her compassion for the patients is great. And I that's part of why I love working with her. I miss her.
I haven't been in the hospital for several months because of trying to finish up the film. That's what she means by I miss her.
Well, there's a big welcome coming back for you. And we'll be coming back for you in just a moment. We're going to take a break. And we'll be back in just a few seconds.
Central Coast Voices continues with our host today, Chris Kington Barker.
Welcome back to Central Coast Voices. And our topic today is the film, The Chaplain and the Doctor, a film that models a new kind of healthcare that combines spirit and body, the diverse backgrounds of patients, and a focus on the most human needs that we all share that are unique to every one of us. My guests are the principals in the film, Chaplain Betty Clark, Chaplain of Staff at Wilmachan Highland Hospital Campus, a level one trauma center in Oakland, California. She's also a teacher, matriarch, grandmother, and a church founder. And Dr. Jessica Zitter, a documentary filmmaker, writer, physician, founder of Real Medicine Media, nonprofit devoted to using story to transform and humanize medical culture. She went on to direct and produce Caregiver, Love Story in 2020 and authored Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to End-of-Life Care in 2017. She's also the creator and the director of the movie, The Chaplain and the Doctor. And welcome back, Betty and Jessica. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we were talking about just the different ways that this film highlights what can be in healthcare and what is in kind of pieces from the compassion of a human being that can go in and spend time with patients, but what we hopefully can generate into a culture of how we can care for one another, human to human, when people are sick and in hospital or any kind of a place that they're trying to heal. What do you, Jessica, you know, as you are a storyteller and you're trying to transform using story for healthcare for, as a teaching tool, what do you want to have happen out of this film?
Well, Betty and I actually have different primary goals. My primary goal is to get this film in front of every single doctor, nurse, social worker, end-of-life doula, anybody who has any role in a hospital environment, so that you can see on the screen some of the challenges and obstacles to humane care and also some of the solutions. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, you know, film and just storytelling in general can provide an emotional priming to the viewer to really make them learn on a different level and really want to be part of the change in a way that a book or a lecture can't do.
Yeah. Yeah. And Betty, how about for you? What do you want?
Well, I want to see chaplains see how they can better work with doctors. I want to see chaplains understand their role, not as a pastoral care, but more as one who comes to help people in that time of healthcare struggles, to tap into their strengths and what lifts them up and what encourages them and what gives them hope. And I was talking to an administrator yesterday who said it would be great to have doctors and chaplains see the film together.
Yes.
And then they can, to have a discussion and talk about. So, yeah, I want to see education happen and hopefully change what chaplains do in hospitals and how they can care for patients in a better way and how they can advocate more with the doctors and how they can partner.
Yes. And you're listening to us talk about The Chaplain and the Doctor with The Chaplain and the Doctor. And if you want to call in and talk with us also, it's 805-781-3875. We'd love to hear from you. Speaking as someone from a patient perspective, you know, what I would love to see from this film is that patients could be empowered to say what it is that they like or don't like, that they could feel empowered to say, I don't understand you, I didn't like that, I'd appreciate it if there's somebody else I could talk to.
You don't understand me.
You don't understand me. I don't think you understand what I'm saying. Clearly, you're not hearing me.
And yeah. I've had patients to say, the doctors come in and they talk to each other about me, but they don't talk to me.
To me, yeah. Yeah. I think there's this remarkable feeling sometimes for people in a hospital that they're being talked over around and that they're not part of their care at all. And it's got to be frightening.
Yes, absolutely.
When now the movie is showing, the film is showing now in some of the film festivals. It's showing in San Francisco next week.
We're very excited to be announcing the world premiere of The Chaplain and the Doctor. It's going to be screened twice at San Francisco International Film Festival next week.
first on Monday the 21st at 6 p.m. and the second time at BAMFA in Berkeley at 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday the 23rd.
Okay. And are there still tickets?
It's tight. But what the festival organizers are saying is that people who come early and stand in the rush line usually can get in.
Okay.
I can't promise.
Okay. And then is this going to be viewed in multiple film festivals, perhaps?
Well, I'll tell you, we are on the festival tour. We've applied to many, many film festivals. We're waiting to hear back from a lot. And eventually, over the next, 6 to 8 months, we're going to start doing a screening tour, hopefully going to a whole variety of medical schools, residencies, doing talks at a variety of locations for people who are interested in screening the film. And we can't wait.
Yes, absolutely. And you're still doing fundraising for this, too. You unfortunately had some funding withdrawn, right?
Well, yes, we did. From California Humanities, many artists have had their funding pulled, unfortunately, given the current circumstances, and it's a real challenge. We still have quite a bit of deficit in our production budget, and also for our impact. I mean, the impact is really the key for this film, and we really are going to need a lot of support. We currently have a crowdraiser going, and if anyone's interested in signing up and supporting us, you can find it at forchaplainandthedoctor.com.
Okay.
And we'd love your support. Please sign up for our e-news as well if you want to be appraised of all of the screenings and festivals that we will be at. If people around the country want to see it, it's a good place to keep track.
Okay. And that's how do people sign up if they want to just stay apprised of what's going on?
Go to thechaplainandthedoctor.com. And there's a couple of things. There's the sign up for our e-news, and that's you'll get updates and follow-ups for the through the e-news. And also there also happens to be the donate button if you're interested in supporting the crowdraiser, which has another, I think, 10 days to go.
Betty, I want to go back to a story that you once told that I heard you tell. It was about a gentleman who was getting really upset because of a word that was being used by a physician that he interpreted really differently. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I was invited by a group of doctors or a team, wasn't a palliative care team. And they had heard that I, could help maybe with conversation. And so they said, Betty, could you go with us to meet with this patient? Because he doesn't seem to understand what we're trying to tell him about his pain medicine. So we went into the room, and I sit quietly listening. And so they started saying, we need to wean you off of this medication. And I looked, and he was getting angry. So I said to the doctors, I said, can we stop the conversation for a minute? So I turned to the patient. I said, what do you hear when they say they want to wean you off of this medication? And he said, I'm no baby. I don't need to be weaned.
Is she allowed to swear on the radio?
It didn't come through.
Oh, good. So he said, I don't need to be weaned. And so I said to him, I said, what they're trying to tell you is that they need to bring your pain medication down as your pain level comes down so you don't get addicted. And he said, oh, bring my medicine down. I don't want to be addicted. And so I told the doctors, their words, especially with African Americans and maybe with other people as well, that makes people feel like you're talking down to them.
Yes.
Words like wean, we use that for babies, weaning babies off of them,
right?
Whatever. And words like poop,
Yes.
And people feel like, why are they talking to me like that?
Yes.
So the doctors have listened.
Yeah. And the reason I wanted to you to share that story was that just being able to hear someone and focus on what it is that they're upset about rather than just getting caught up in the emotion of their anger is something that all of us can learn from. Because it's, again, stepping back and not putting ourselves into the picture of it's not about us.
Right, right. It's not about me.
Yeah. Yeah, but being able to make it about the patient and being able to hear what is that really about. Does it take...
And they won't say that to a doctor. You know, sometimes doctors are in the room and they'll say, well, we're going to try this. And if this doesn't work, we're going to try that. And when they leave out of the room, they... family or the patient turns to me and says, are they experimenting on me?
Yeah. What do you think that your way, Betty, and Jessica, maybe you can speak to this too, does it take a tremendous amount of more time?
Well, I can speak to that because I will tell you that as an ICU doctor, I would have sometimes 12, 14 patients in, you know, on my list, and they were really critically ill, as you can imagine. And I still figured out how to find the time. You know, you'd have to prioritize who needed connection the most, but you can almost always have an important meeting. And frankly, you don't even need to have a meeting outside of the room. Sometimes it's just about connecting. We, even with a person on a ventilator, looking at them in the eyes, putting your hand on them if it seems like they're okay with that, and just showing them that you care about them. So I think it's not necessarily even an issue of time. I think it's an issue of will.
Is it an...
And,
yeah, go ahead.
And for me, as a chaplain on the palliative care team, we sometimes have 23 patients on our list with one chaplain and two or more doctors. And so I'm running around trying to see as many patients as I can. But still, 10, 15 minutes with a patient makes a big difference.
Yeah. So.
And I would say even 1 minute with a patient makes a difference.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing of, gee, this takes too long to do it this way, really is discounted.
Yes. We would both say yes, yes. Again, sometimes you don't have time to do a 10-minute meeting. Sometimes you really have time for a 30-second stop at the bed and connect with somebody, even if they can't speak with you.
Right.
But I think that that is something we can always do.
And it makes sense to do that. What is your general routine outside of now the last 2 months, Jessica? I understand that you've been out of the hospital, but do you generally work together now?
I would say when I'm on service, and I work, you know, probably between 40% and 60% time, depending on the year, because I'm spending a lot of time on my nonprofit and making other media. The rest of the time, pretty much when I'm on palliative service, Betty and I are glued together at the hip.
I was going to say the same thing. When she's there, I work with her.
And how do the patients respond to that?
They love us because we come in with smiles, and Jessica will sit anywhere. She'll sit on the floor. She'll sit... She's very comfortable, and that makes the patients comfortable. You know, a lot of doctors come in, they're stiff.
Yeah.
Wall, and Jessica is right there at the patient's side.
What are your plans going forward with this program? Is this something that you're going to be teaching or doing anything internally with, or is it really about the film and using the film for external teaching?
No, we are very committed. We certainly want to screen it and get people excited about it. It's a, I think, if I may say so, it's a very powerful, funny, poignant film. I think people will resonate with it. We want to get it in front of, again, as we said, as many people as we can, certainly healthcare providers, certainly chaplains. And really, we're committed to creating programming. We've already started doing that. I have a keynote that uses several clips from the film. You know, in a keynote situation, you don't have time to show the entire film, but we can do that separately. But it shows several clips from the film and really kind of creates a compelling argument for the things that Betty and I are talking about really trying to be aware of judgment and labeling. And by being aware, you know, that's the first step to sort of addressing it. And also really creating asynchronous programming that the healthcare educators can use that include things that could be just done on Zoom once we get this into the educational distribution mode, which is, you know, about 6 to 8 months down the line.
And some of...
I want to work on a workbook for chaplains around what we learn in the film.
That's a great idea, Betty. Yeah, that would go along with this?
Yes.
Fantastic. Now, the film features a number of patients who have unique circumstances. And then does it show some of the things that they're up against and then also some of the interactions with them and then some of the solutions or resolutions or maybe no resolution?
Well, there are several stories where there is a lot of, you know, challenge and concern. As you watch the film, you sort of start to see the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, many of our patients have died by now because they were very, very ill.
Right.
But there are a few, actually several, who will be coming to the screenings.
Okay, great. Fantastic. And when you're continuing with this whole concept, how would you like this to take off in the hospital? How do you want to grow it there?
Well, I believe that there is a serious role for using film in the education of healthcare providers. I really believe that it's a powerful driver for change. Much more so than any kind of didactic experience or even, frankly, a patient actor that you could interact with. I think those are great ways to learn, too. But there's something about seeing real people, real stories on the screen, patients and caregivers like us, that really can be sort of generative of new approaches to, you know, individuals and the way that they practice medicine. And so I really do want to, you know, what we do at Real Medicine Media is to try very hard to figure out how to get these films that we've made into the use in the classroom, in the residency programs, in hospitals and hospices, nursing schools, chaplaincy schools, and get people to sort of learn new ways and be inspired to practice in new ways.
I really love the idea of using it for chaplaincy training. I mean, one of the things that I've seen in some of the hospitals is that they're, even though they're are trained chaplains, a lot of the community hospitals don't have chaplains who have been residency trained or feel really comfortable interacting even with patients who are dying. So it would be wonderful to have a tool to help them. Really wonderful.
Yeah. And in this film, you see the struggle between the doctor and the chaplain with a patient that you're not expecting to encounter the situation with the patient and struggling on how do we react to this? How do we respond to this? How do we help the patient? How do we make a difference? And we work through it. And I think it's really powerful for people to understand that, as I said, it's not about us.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you take yourself out of it, you realize that, hey, this is really serious for this person. How can we help? How can we make a difference?
Yes. I'm Chris Kington Barker for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported station. I want to invite you, if you would like to call in at 805-781. Oh, I'm getting a no signal from Donna, so we don't have time for you to call in. I'm going to continue with Jessica and with Betty. So, Betty.
Yes.
When you are with your patients, and are you there Monday through Friday?
I am.
Okay. And what happens on the weekends? Do you have patients that are being seen on the weekends as well?
I triage on the weekends. If I get a call, I usually ask the nurses calling, would the patient like a priest?
Mm-hmm.
Are they wanting prayer? And usually I say, well, what is their faith and do they want? And the nurse will say, oh, I have to go find out, because they just decided to call a chaplain. But I also supervise and train chaplain volunteers. So we're going to have some volunteers who will be in on weekends, which will help.
Fantastic.
That is frequently in the hospital on the weekends. Many, many times I've seen or heard Betty spending time on the weekends with patients.
And Betty, for the physicians, are they getting used to calling in the chaplains to come in with them as well, or are you about the only one doing it right now?
Right now, they call me.
They call you.
And, yeah.
So you're still teaching everybody.
We have a hospital chaplain. But that, you know, we have one hospital chaplain, and he has the whole hospital. But they're comfortable with me, and so they will usually call me and ask if I can come and see a patient.
Is this something that you could see really growing, so that they're more likely to be using other people as well? Because there's only one of you.
Yes. Yes. That's why I'm training volunteers.
Well, Chris, it's a lot like the palliative care movement. I mean, it's
true.
It, there was not much of a demand in the early 2000s when I started practicing palliative care.
Right.
We had to rustle up cases. I mean, almost a deluge.
So
it's about raising awareness. If people start to understand the value that chaplains bring,
right,
if other healthcare providers, doctors, et cetera, then this could become, what starts being a trickle could become a real flow.
Well, and I think if people start to see the spiritual side of it, in terms of when people are anxious, it may be that it's not more pain medication that they need. Maybe it's because they're anxious or they're fearful. Maybe they need somebody to sit and talk with them, and that may be a chaplain. That isn't because it is a religious thing. It's because it is really a spiritual issue.
And they need someone to hear their story.
Right.
It makes a big difference. We had a patient who came from the street, very angry because of his life and what has happened to him. And he would curse everybody out, and he'd send people out of his room. But before he died, he asked me to sit down, come in, sit down. And I sat by his bed and held his hand, and he told me his story. And he actually ended up with a nurse who came in and sat with him, and his niece came in and said goodbye before he died. So he died in peace rather than in that angry state that he was in when he came in.
Can I just add something to that, which is, Chris, you will understand and appreciate this more than anybody, but I think end-of-life doulas are a really unrecognized force here that could be so important and so helpful to the humanizing of this experience for people. And I'm a big, big advocate for end-of-life doulas.
I know you are. And absolutely. I can see how that is a role that can work, too. When we talk about people not understanding or limited abilities or people being discriminated against. The other group of people that gets discriminated against often in a healthcare setting is people who have limited abilities, physical abilities.
Yeah.
Or people who have limited abilities with cognitive abilities. Have you run into that, and how do you deal with that?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, we see that a lot. You know, there's just so many differences in the hospital that are at risk of being shut down, ignored, and not listened to. And I think you're right that people with, you know, different learning or who are not English speaking are there's so many things that put somebody at risk for not being attended to and, you know, having people be curious about who you are and your story. And I think it's just extremely, extremely dangerous and harmful.
Yes. Or literacy, you know, people who are, you know, who are dyslexic or people who have difficulty with writing or reading, any number of things. So, you know, and those are things that people are not going to be forthcoming with necessarily in expressing. So, you know, those take dignity and patience and kindness in order to help someone feel comfortable. And, you know, those are often overlooked. You know, the person that starts clicking their teeth because the person in front of them is in a wheelchair or moves too slowly or something.
I can tell you a funny story. When I was doing hospice, the social worker asked me to come and visit a patient with him because he couldn't understand what the patient was saying. The patient spoke English, but came from the South.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was sitting there, and the patient said, "You may be excused." And the social worker looked at me and, "What's he talking about?" I said, "He wants you to leave."
Well, there it is. And I think, you know, one of the things that we need to be aware of is hearing impairment, too. So all kinds of things.
Yeah.
We're running out of time here. I'm so grateful that you came on with me. I want to really thank Betty Clark, Chaplain Betty Clark, Dr. Jessica Zitter for joining me today. Next week, please join host Lata Murthy and her guests. Thank you for taking time to join us today and for being a KCBX listener and supporter. We appreciate you. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for being here.